Hello and thanks for tuning in to show 5 of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we've themed ourselves again. I'm wearing knackered Converse and my producer is simply hiding behind her messy fringe. We've gone indie to explore the world of independent record labels. We have the label-owning Mighty Pipe Norwegian singer Anna Brun playing an exclusive, breathtaking Midori House session. She'll also tell us why she runs her own label.
Choose your own tempo, you choose the deadlines, you choose the form you want to release anything in, and nobody could tell me to go on tour for 6 months. It's always my decision.
We'll be speaking to Gilda Loek, co-owner of Paris's chicest label Kitsune. He'll tell us the story behind signing bands and cooking up those amazing Kitsune compilations.
The passion is one thing, and I believe also if you do like having a good proposal, I think you can like create your own space onto the market and build, like, which we are doing actually with the music label.
We'll also be joined by Travis Elbera, author of The Vinyl Countdown, about whether it's sound business sense or just nostalgia that's behind independence embrace of vinyl.
There has been a revival of kind of people pressing up vinyl because in essence it's become far easier just to bung your music out on the internet.
Plus an amusing report from Tokyo's TV Commercials Festival, an indie-themed book corner, and our design editor gets all audio to make us a lovely 1 minute of sound. That is the definition of culture with me, Robert Bound, right here on Monocle 24. Welcome to Culture. I'm Robert Bound, and thank God I'm not in the studio on my own. This week, I'm joined from Norway via Stockholm by the wonderful singer-songwriter and independent label owner, Anna Brun. Anna Brun, welcome to the Culture Show.
Thank you.
I say it right?
Yes, you did. Very well.
A little bit. Will you say it for us to say that we've got it?
Anna Brun.
Okay, right, okay. So which part of Scotland are you from? Sorry, I had to say that because you sort of...
Just across the water.
You joked about it before.
Yeah, just fine. Across the water.
Yes. So you've come in to play for us. There was a bit of a hiatus between your last record and this one. And I hear because you were touring and all the rest of it. Maybe you can tell us about where you've been, who you've played with, who new friends are, and why it took so long for you to make another beautiful record.
Yeah, I had toured on my latest album, Change of the Seasons, for years, it felt. And then I was going to write and do new songs, and I got an email from Peter Gabriel's people, and they asked if I wanted to come on tour. And something that started out as a short tour became a long tour. So I've done quite a few trips with them this year. And I wrote a little bit on tour as well, but it came in the winter. Songs.
It sounds like quite a wintry album. Is that fair to say? Someone earlier told me that you made cold weather music.
Yeah, it's written in January,
okay,
February of this year, I guess, in my studio in Stockholm. It's quite cold there at that time.
And does it bear itself out in the music? Do you think that your music sounds the way it does because it comes from chilly climes?
During 3 months of the year, we can't really go outside and do things. You just walk from your door to the next place you're going to. And I guess you're spending a lot of time inside your houses. And I think that makes you focus on things.
We're going to now kick off with your first track, and it's called Do You Remember? Can you tell us about that? Is there anything salient that we should know so that when we listen to it, we're wiser than we were otherwise?
Well, this is the version that I'm playing here is how it's written. Uh-huh. At home in my living room just like a morning before I was going to a meeting. It was really weird, fast songwriting, this one. And then the version that you hear on the album is a lot bigger. It's with three drummers, mm-hmm, and a bass player.
It's got kind of a tribal kind of beat,
yes,
to it.
Yes, so it's
it?
A bit different. It's the same kind of... Well, I hope that you can hear the desperation of the lyrics even in that happy drumming part. So.
Well, here we are then. Do you remember?
Do you remember the late morning when we went back to bed? When we found our first position and every muscle rested? I do remember that I already knew it was the last time. The last time for first positions. The last time you're being mine. Do you remember the scars I showed you, the stories I told you? How I always said forever when you asked me to stay true.
Do you remember how we forgot how to smile at each other? To believe that the other wants only what's good for you.
This is Culture with me, Robert Bound. You just heard Do You Remember, which was performed for us by Anna Brune.
On Do You Remember, you were playing quite a small guitar for us there.
Yeah.
Is that your soul guitar? Is that your pride and joy? Does that go with you everywhere? Is that the thing that you kind of make notes on almost? Mm-hmm. Or is it just a small guitar?
It's become actually that kind of guitar. It wasn't for a long time. It was just something I bought in America in 2006. But I ended up just writing a lot of songs on it. It just makes me feel, I don't know, it's quite unpretentious in a way. You pick it up and you just start playing without thinking that you're supposed to write anything. And then that's the time when everything just gets going in a way. I actually did care a lot about my guitars before, but yeah. I kind of had to decide not to, because when you travel with them so much, they crack up and they... I just try to see them as tools these days, because there's so many good guitars.
Yeah,
you can just change if you have to. You know,
it must be like to be you.
Terrible.
I smashed them up. Did you smash them up? Have you ever engaged in on stage cruelty to musical instruments?
No, I would never do that though.
Okay,
that's just very provocative, I think.
So your new record, It All Starts With One, and I think all your records, in fact, have been self-released.
Yes.
By the auspicious Balloon Ranger Recordings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's your own record label.
Yes.
And you were presumably quite pioneering in having your own record label.
In Sweden, I was one of the first. I think we were two or three artists at the time. 2003 was my first album. It was quite interesting, because the channels that exist today, they weren't there. So you had to find your own way through everything. And I found a distribution deal with V2 Records at the time. For me, it was kind of like a choice that I did, because I didn't feel I got any real feedback from people that felt that they really wanted to work. It just felt like lame somehow. And I wanted to just do things. I wanted to make the album and play, yeah. And I didn't really feel like they had to make me a big star or anything. I just wanted to play music. And all of a sudden, from having this small label in Sweden, I got a phone call that the V2 offices around Europe wanted to release my album. So all of a sudden it became a European release, and it was just me, and I was kind of panicking. So I brought in a manager at the time, and he's the one who's stayed with me since then. So we're kind of dealing with the label together. And I've done the independent thing all the way, and it's been very good for me. It's been good for my creative process.
Are you a good boss to yourself?
I think
Have you ever threatened to sack yourself?
I guess.
Have you ever sat on one side of the table smoking a cigar and then had to sit on the other side going, okay, I'll make three albums for you?
Yeah, I think my problem has been that I haven't really realised that I'm the boss sometimes. That I actually
That's a good
can,
position to be in, I think.
That I actually can say no and say yes and all these things. So I guess it's the good girl problem, good girl syndrome.
Have you got a good work ethic?
Yeah, I do.
Would you give yourself a pay rise if you were the boss?
I give myself good things that makes touring better and, you know, more... Like a little bit better hotels and a little bit better traveling. No morning flights, you know, those kind of things.
No, God.
No, God.
God forbid. Is it still great being on an independent label? Or do you ever kind of wish that everything was taken care for by sort of EMI or by, you know, Warner Brothers or something?
I think there are moments when I see that I would want that. It's moments when I feel that it would be nice if someone just take all the responsibility so I could just focus on the music. But at the same time, there's so many good sides of being independent, because you can always choose your own tempo, you choose the deadlines, you choose the form you want to release anything in, and especially the luxury of actually be able to plan your time, and just nobody could tell me to go on tour for 6 months. It's always my decision, and I don't owe anyone anything. There's never been any question of demand. Now you have to do an album, or you have to do this kind of album, or we need a single or whatever like that. It's just, it's always been very intuitive. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been important because it's, I'm a self-taught musician and my career has been a education. I need to learn all the time. So nobody's had to tell me anything.
Is touring and playing live still the best way of promoting yourself, especially when you're your own label and you're your own singer?
I think it's still very good. I think I discovered a band last night, actually, just by seeing them for 45 minutes. And they were called Gardens and Villa from America. And they were really good live. And I guess to promote yourself live, you have to be good, I guess. These days, everyone's touring. There's so much music everywhere and you have to be really good. I think I have a concept that is working really well because I can do the big thing, I can do the big band thing, which I'm doing on this tour in the UK. And I can also do the thing I'm doing here with you guys, the little session thing. So for me, it's been good. I've done that since the beginning. I play all these little cafes and the strangest places. And some bands can't do that.
I wanted to ask you this. You found that you listened to this new band, Gardens and Villas, last night. I always think that musicians like different music to people that like music like.
I'm not sure. I guess maybe you appreciate virtuosity when you are a musician somehow. You kind of strive to become better and better, and then you see someone that is really, really good in what they do. And also that you listen to things that maybe people who don't play music don't even notice. The normal people is not... That's a weird. But the non-musicians maybe don't care, you know, about the things that you actually spent 4 days thinking about during the recordings. So, because the most important thing is what I learned after all these years is that the most important thing is the whole feeling, the whole expression of the album. That's what reaches people. That's what communicates. It doesn't matter if the hand claps are on the left or the right side of the panoramic. I don't know. So it's the whole feeling, you know. It's a communication. So I guess maybe that's it. You get a bit nerdy because you've been around it so much.
Oh, I wanted to talk about the album. I want to go back to It All Starts With One, because I've just been given this deluxe. Shall we call it deluxe?
Yes, let's call it deluxe.
I'm unfolding now a double CD deluxe version of the record. Can I ask you about the song called Lamento della Ninfa?
Yes.
That's because we're going to listen to that in a minute. Mm-hmm. And that is a song by Monteverdi, right?
Yes.
I'm going to keep on saying these things as if I innately know them, but I think I should get you to explain the genesis of the song, because it's a song from, it's a sort of lament, or it's a love song from the 17th century?
16th century. Oh, 17th
so
century
close.
Is probably close. That's a
1600s.
Exactly. So it's the thing is, it started a few years ago. I was studying music, and we were particularly studying Baroque opera. And this kind of music has a lot of amazing melodies, and it's really easy to adapt to the singer-songwriter genre that I'm in. I did some projects, and this particular one I did with a chamber orchestra in Stockholm. And I translated the Italian lyric to English. And I did that with Google Translate and some of my Spanish knowledge.
So it could be wrong. So you could be singing, I mean,
it
that sounds rashly unprofessional.
Yes, it could be very wrong, but, you know, it's the mix of two worlds. The internet and the 1600s.
I like that. Yeah. It all meets somewhere in the middle.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to listen to this song. And do you want to introduce it? It's called, we're calling it Lamento della Ninfa. That's the original.
That's the original. I usually just call it O Love.
Anna Bruhn, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Oh love, oh love, oh love, where is it his faithfulness was promised to me? I've been deceived, I'm lost. Please bring his love to me the way it was before. Oh, let me die now. Then it won't hurt me more. It will not hurt me. It will not hurt me no more. Far away from me. No, he so proud standing in this light. The light I spread on him, if I would leave him in the shadows, would he come back for me? Are her eyes as bright, her kisses as light, as feathers on your skin? Oh, love, the value of your true heart in your hand lasts longer than her kiss ever can. Her kiss could never hold this true love like my heart. Please do not speak, my love. You know this all so well. Just love me, love me.
That was Oh Love by Anna Bruhn, playing for us here exclusively for The Culture Show on Monocle 24. Hope you're enjoying it. We'll be back with a literary bit of Copenhagen in just a second.
Most of us just imagine the future, but some people are shaping it. Presented by Mercedes-Benz, The Avant-Garde Diaries is a digital portrait magazine profiling the people whose passion and creativity drive change. Meet the visionaries of our time at theavantgardediaries.com.
For a complete briefing on the business of design, join us for Section D. Every week, Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, brings you the world of design in a perfectly formed package, looking at architecture, industrial design, fashion, retail, and graphics. Monocle 24's Section D brings the world of design to you, the Monocle listener. That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. And also available on our Timeshift player at monocle.com and on iTunes.
Welcome back. You're tuned to Culture. I'm Robert Bound. Every week, we want to give you a little cultural slice from one of our favourite parts of the world via an independent bookshop, record shop or cinema. Now off we trot to Copenhagen to check out Timmer's Magazine, a cosy bookshop in the city's bustling Vesterbro district.
Hi, I'm Anna. I'm a shopkeeper at Timmer's Magazine here in Copenhagen, which is a small independent bookshop. It's been around for about 10 years, almost 5 years at this address location. It's a neighborhood with a lot of 30, 40-year-old people with small kids. Who also come to buy children's books and buy all their Christmas presents, get them wrapped nicely. A lot of local people, loyal customers who always come here to buy their books, but also people from all over Denmark, from different places in the world, who say that they read about the magazine or the bookshop in a magazine or somewhere. We choose books that we like, things we read and know we love or would like to read if we had more time. And we also try to specialize in beautiful books, you know, a beautiful edition of an interesting book. Right now, the number one would be Haruki Murakami's new book in Danish. Murakami is a special author for this bookshop, since Christina, the shop owner, she declared a few years ago that he had written the world's best book, the best book in the whole world. That's the Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. And it's been quoted quite a lot. So we have a lot of customers coming in asking for the best book in the whole world. And she's become a bit of a Murakami celebrity in Denmark, you could say. And so when the new book was released, we just had a lot of people coming in saying the new book by the best author in the world. This is a Danish publisher who's published a series of classics with really beautiful covers. They published a lot of my favorite books. Perec's, what's it called? Life, a User's Manual. Virginia Woolf, Bulgakov's The Master and Margarita. They make a lot of nice books. Those are some of my favorites. They're very simple. I'll just show you one or two of them. They choose some... they choose a background color, always a small illustration, and then just text, basically. They keep it very simple, but in a very tempting way, I think. Oh, there's another thing. The Gestalten books that you probably know, but you can't get them in Roman places in Denmark. So we have a lot of customers coming in asking for them, and they make beautiful books on design and architecture, graphic design, art.
That was Anna at Temir's Magazine in Copenhagen, provided by our very own David Michel. Still to come in part two of Culture with me, Robert Bound, we're going to Tokyo for a high-energy report. Our man Kenji Hall takes in the Tokyo Commercial Film Festival. And Gilda Loek from Kitsune joins us to talk about how business and cool meet on his record label. Plus, the author of The Vinyl Countdown presents his book corner. Carrying on with our theme, independent record labels, a little earlier I spoke to Gilda Loek, co-founder of the supercool Paris record label and fashion house Kitsune, whose compilations have been a fixture on the Monocle Hi-Fi since way back when. Gilda, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us today.
Ma'am, thank you very much for inviting me.
I hope you don't find our studio setup too strict. I know that you have been instructed to talk directly into the microphone and to look at the microphone.
I understand. Everywhere I need rules. I totally understand that. It's okay.
What are Kitsune's rules?
Try to be, self-efficient.
Yeah.
And like developing, growing, like being creative.
And I wanted to ask you about that then, because it does seem very self-sufficient and creative and kind of forward-moving. It's got a good momentum. You set up, is it in 2002? Was that the clothing line as well as the record label, or did they happen at different times?
The original idea was always to make both, but like the music label been like spreading faster in a way than like the clothesline, where like MP3 and like digital is like with internet like going very fast everywhere. So where like the clothesline, where we needed to find and making like partnership with like fabric maker and like manufacturer.
And so the record label started at the same time then as the clothes?
Yeah. The idea was always to make both together. Yes.
And is choosing the fabric the most important part of both of those operations? Is choosing the fabric of your compilations, the fabric of your music, is that the same kind of international search through?
But the idea is, yes, to at the best we can is to care about the quality. So mm-hmm. And like in terms of like music label, what is important obviously is the writing and the song. So what we try with the music label is like working and developing artists which are writing quality songs in a way for the clothesline, we also care about like what the fabric is and from where it is coming and like who is making it. You know, that's the kind of like link that we can have between both areas that we're working on, yes.
How do you go about starting a record label? Especially, you know, in 2002 when the music industry was changing and independent record labels like yours are small and difficult.
I always say that we start the music label at the worst time. Because,
right.
Yeah, like at the time we were starting is at the time that the music business was start to collapse, which is actually really collapsing because I think the market been divided by 10 into the time we were starting. But the passion is one thing, and I believe also if you do like having a good proposal, I think you can like create your own space onto the market and build, like which we are doing actually with the music label, where we are developing each year and growing up are like when the music business is like getting down. So I think which make us believe that we are making the good choice and proposing the good project maybe.
And is there a kind of model that you followed, or is it just literally this is what we like and we're going to stick out our necks and release this stuff? Is that about as much as you can do? Trust your instincts and trust your taste?
On top of I like the project and I like the artist, I like the song, I need to see and believe that it will at some point have some possible income in a way, like compared to what we invest into it. You can't risk that much as it used to be the case. So you need to be sure that it is making sense economically and that you give the maximum chance to get some return to the investment. So it's not only about passion, like 100%, I will say.
And lots of the artists, or you know, there are artists that crop up on your compilations quite often. Are they sort of friends of the family, or are they just CDs that you always have on in the office?
When you sign an artist and you want to, let's say, like, oh, I'm signing Tudor Cinema Club, like, which is the main project we got on Kitsune, the music label, and I need to get along well with the member of the band, with the management, and because when we put them in studio, like, to record the album, and when we finish the campaign, like, after all the single and the touring and everything, is maybe 4 years of common life in a way where we are like daily talking, and like, so you need to have a good relationship and love the people. Like, I don't want to work with people I don't like, actually, which is I prefer not if I got the choice, which I got, so I work with people I like usually.
You've got quite a niche, but how do you see the sort of record label scene evolving with digital and with major labels sort of crumbling, and is it a pretty landscape or is it Armageddon?
I think an independent label like Kitsune, obviously, is also, I would say, harmed in a way by the fact that the market is not that good. But for me, it's kind of positive in where I can develop and propose project and build. And internet is magic for that because you have other alternative way of promoting the project. And also the music in itself can also like spread through a more organic way of promoting, you know, so... that's where we are working on, actually. I think streaming is the new way of getting to the music for younger people.
Okay. And how do you make money then out of it, if people are streaming it?
We get deals with all that company which are streaming the music for us. So Spotify is getting like incredibly good. So it is like a lot of people like getting access to our catalog and whatsoever, like also in another way. So it's very good.
Gilda from Kitsune, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And now we're going to hear True Romance by Citizens from compilation 12 of Kitsune, released this week.
True romance.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Band, where you just heard True Romance by Citizens from compilation 12 of Kitsune, released this week. Up next, our man in Tokyo, Kenji Hall, gets sucked into the world of advertising at Tokyo's 10th International TV Commercial Festival, a strange and charming all-nighter that runs from 11 p.m. to 5 a.m. Here he is, possibly doing shots of sake on the job.
My name is Jean-Christian Bouvier. I'm a French guy living in Japan, and I'm the producer of The Night of the Editors. The Night of the Editors, in French, it's La Nuit des Publivores. In Japanese, it's Sekai no Sien Festival. It's the craziest event you can think of to make people pay to watch commercials. Who would think about that? Usually at home, it's commercial time, you go to take a beer in the kitchen, but you would never pay to watch commercial. But the Night of the Editors, it's so much fun that people pay to come, and they come again every year. It starts at 10 in the evening. It ends at 5:30 in the morning. 500 commercials from all over the world on a giant screen with live bands, performance. It's the greatest event. It's a big circus. 1,000 people tonight, and maybe the same tomorrow.
So how many nights will this go for?
I'm 62 years old, so we do it only Friday night and Saturday night. And I just hope on Sunday I'm still alive.
And how long does it take you to prepare for this event?
We start every year in April. From April, May, we do the program, and we start the show in June until the March next year. And we change one third in September because I get great commercials from the London Advertising Producer Association. So we are working on it all year round.
It starts in Fukuoka?
It starts in Fukuoka.
And then where does it go after that?
It goes to Hiroshima, Kagoshima, Amakusa. You never heard of Amakusa. It's a small place, only one movie house, 90 seats, sold out. We go to Okinawa, to Nagoya, about 20 cities, from Okinawa to Hokkaido.
Where are we? We're standing in the lobby.
Yeah, we are in the lobby of Milanoichi, in the heart of Kabukicho in Tokyo. And it's the biggest movie house in Tokyo, 1,000 seats. And I have people who come and sell coffee, sell crepe, we sell wine. When people want to sell things, I say, okay, come, but don't come to make money. Come not to lose money, but to make people happy.
And what's the entertainment for tonight? In between, you know, you have breaks.
We have 5 breaks.
Okay.
But with the breaks means live performance, drag queen in the lobby, fantastic band. The Kansas City band was on stage for 8 minutes. They will play in the lobby. I have another band at the opening of the third part. Then the Coloridas, our staff, they have a nice band too before the lottery.
They're the ones who we heard coming into the,
yes.
Into the entrance.
But they will play a different style on the stage. And before the last part, all the musicians who are left, they come together and they have a big jam session on stage.
And what time will that be at?
4:30 in the morning. Good morning, Tokyo.
Tell me, how many countries these commercials have come from?
About 40 countries. When I do the editing, I'd be very careful, not only French, not only English, but also from Africa, from Serbia, from Croatia, from Russia, any country you never think of.
And do the commercials translate? Because they're in different languages.
Yes, but we put Japanese subtitles on all of them, and it's a lot of work. Usually it's a commercial, it's an art for people who watch TV. So it's very middle class. and middle class is average all over the world. It's good fun. It's not hypo, no long speeches. It's a handmade festival. Maybe if you think of the money spent to make these 500 commercials, it's more than 10 Hollywood movies. The money involved in making this commercial is the most expensive show in the world.
That was Kenji Hall at the Commercial Festival in Tokyo. This is Culture with me, Robert Bound.
Most of us just imagine the future, but some people are shaping it. Presented by Mercedes-Benz, The Avant-Garde Diaries is a digital portrait magazine profiling the people whose passion and creativity drive change. Meet the visionaries of our time at theavantgardediaries.com.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes, and quips of the week, tune into The Curator every Sunday here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programs you might have missed and is also the perfect digest of the week in world affairs, business, culture, and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now joining me in the studio to polish off our independent record label themed show is author of The Vinyl Countdown and record aficionado, Travis Elborough. We've talked to other people earlier in the show about the essence of independence and all the rest of it. How tied up do you think that is in the idea of vinyl? Do you think it's a sort of nostalgic notion, the idea of independence?
Well, I mean, you could argue that the invention of vinyl in the late 40s and 1948, with the creation of the LP by Columbia and the 45 by RCA initially, opens up the record market to thousands of enthusiasts around the world, and also the arrival of the tape player. So independence, in a way, by means that, you know, anyone now could go and record, you know, their local folk group, take the tape in, have 500 copies of it pressed up, and, you know, and sell it.
And this is because making a vinyl LP or a 45 was incredibly easy.
Becomes a lot easier, process. Yeah. One of the famous kind of independent labels in America, Folkways, they operate, you know, largely on small pressings. You know, they receive their orders. When they get enough orders, they can post an album of, you know, Bolivian singing or, you know, Marxist speeches or Woody Guthrie's Dust Bowl songs, and they can, in essence, kind of compete with the big labels. There's a catalogue which is called Swan's Long Playing Catalogue, which is just kind of a listings of all the albums which are available at that particular time, which is almost like the precursor to the cliche of cliches, but the internet and, you know, things like MySpace.
It sounds similar to what people were doing on MySpace, an amalgamation of stuff, being able to go from Colombian folk singing to Woody Guthrie in kind of one click seems to be the kind of essence of
Definitely. And that's another thing about vinyl as well. I mean, the idea of the liner note, the sleeve notes, that you, in essence, can address your public directly from the back of your record.
I want to talk about the liner notes because you're also going to provide us with this week's book corner, which is a Tom Lehrer liner note.
Bookish.
More bookish than some of them have been. You'd be surprised. Anyway, but the idea of creating a world for your audience.
Yeah.
And this is obviously something we think of it in terms of, I mean, moving on from Tom Lehrer and all the rest of it, thinking of people like Bowie and people that entirely created their own world, their own image, and had a sort of great sense of ownership over it. This is presumably something to go back to, celebrating independence and maybe looking with a slightly cockeyed at the iPod. And I think it's a phrase in your book which was, you know, looking at the Lilliputian album covers on a girl's iPod or iPhone on the bus. Does that exist anymore? Like Lady Gaga, they are a huge stage presence.
Sure.
For a singer-songwriter, the opportunities are lesser or greater?
As far as it being bound up in the object, obviously we have gone beyond the kind of existential thinginess of the object. You know, that has gone, or it has changed, put it that way. I mean, one of the things that there has been a revival of kind of people pressing up vinyl, because in essence it's become far easier just to bung your music out on the internet and almost to kind of show your mettle and your faith in what you're doing. Pressing up, you know, 500 singles of what you're doing provides you with something to sell. I mean, one of the things that's happening more and more, I mean, you know, labels labels like Matador, a more contemporary independent, you know, you buy a new album on Matador and it will come with a code which will give you the download. So you can have a kind of dual purpose where you can have it on the, you know, on the hoof in your phone or on your iPod, or you can have the kind of hard copy for home. I mean, there's two things, isn't there? When one is that the internet, the Lilliputian screen thing, but on that you can also, you know, read countless biogs, you can probably watch videos, you can do, there are kind of a range of different forms of interaction. Whereas if you go back, you know, 15, 20 years, all you've got is the record and the format. And that was obviously immensely creative.
And what is the contemporary alternative to those beautiful sleeves? Or is it a website? Or is it putting an album onto an iPad and giving people some sort of scrolling through thing and something, or something larger that you can look at that isn't clearly a tiny iPod?
Yeah,
does it have to be on paper or cardboard? Does it have to sort of be a record?
I mean, arguably not. There are elements of these things which are, you know, partly about the format and partly beyond that. I guess, ideally, one would want something that does some of those aesthetic things on an iPad. And there's no reason why that shouldn't be the case. And that's the experience with which ongoing people are going to experience their music. You know, so the iPod is only 10 years and probably already outmoded in how we listen to our music. I mean, I think this is the whole thing. I mean, even my book, when it was published, you know, Spotify wasn't on anyone's radar. I don't think it was even existence at that point. And that's, you know, that speed with which things have been transformed and how we consume our music is kind of ongoing, really. But I mean, I suppose the other problem, going back to the idea of independence, is that we're almost so independent now that labels themselves are slightly unnecessary.
Well, this is the thing I wanted to ask you. I wanted to ask you a straight question about, you know, almost to do with the subtitle of your book, you know, from vinyl to iPod and back again. Is that possible? I mean, is there enough interest? Are there enough sales involved to make it a genuine thing? Or is it the preserve of the micro label, of the super independent, of the bedroom project? You know,
I probably suspect the latter, if I'm honest. Mm. But the sales have apparently been remarkably healthy. I mean, the whole point, even someone like Amazon now sells vinyl records. You can order them direct from there. The bigger issue, I guess, for everyone now is, you know, how you make money from music or your music without, you know, you either license it for advertising or, but you're not going to be able to sell the kind of the product, put it that way. I mean, that's the other thing about independence as well, is that the reason lots of independent labels thrived because they were able to sell merchandise, for want of a better word, music. And from that, they were able to sustain themselves and produce bodies of work which the major labels and so on were willing to kind of ignore or didn't think had the same commercial potential. But by doing things very cheaply, I mean, that's certainly the thing with kind of the punk era.
Do you think we're sort of again in a kind of punk era, because the internet was the similar DIY aesthetic that punk kind of purported to be when it broke out of all the kind of reacted against the big labels and the sort of languorous guitar solos of the mid-1970s. Yeah. Are we back in that era, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, in the sense we're not, because that form of transformation of the music industry and how people buy their music and the kind of the affront that represented doesn't really exist. What exists in a way is a much more amorphous and easily enterable musical world, in a way that, you know, that anyone can put anything out, but is anyone going to listen to it? You know, there's still layers in the pecking order of how important you are in the musical universe and whether people take notice of you. And so in essence, who recommends things and how people learn about stuff is different. But I think it's as positive as it can be in the sense that there are, you know, the whole history of the musical universe is out there and easy to get hold of. And that's another interesting thing about, you know, both the internet, meaning that you can track down obscure vinyl releases as well as finding kind of music in that sense.
Cool. Well, Travis Elborough, author of The Vinyl Countdown and The Long Player Goodbye, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back with Travis's Book Corner, which is a Tom Lehrer sleeve note, after this. It's time for Book Corner. We're going to do it live today. It's very exciting.
You're blowing me.
well, as live, yeah, Travis. Don't worry. It's fine. Maybe you can introduce it yourself.
Yes. In essence, my Book Corner, which is some sleeve notes on the back of songs by Tom Lehrer. Now, Tom Lehrer can largely be seen as the father of both DIY music and almost college rock. He sings his kind of ditties and his comic songs, his satirical tunes when he's a student at Harvard at parties. He tries to interest major labels in, you know, in these songs. No one is interested. So he books himself into a studio, you know, for $15, records these songs and has, you know, 400 copies of them pressed up, which he then sells to students, and he becomes this kind of underground college hit. And there's even a point where he has to keep repressing the album. He approaches RCA, who are then dealing with Elvis Presley, and RCA turn him down because these songs are too controversial for them. They fear they will...
controversial than Elvis's...
Exactly.
...pelvis.
Precisely. So this is from Tom Lehrer's sleeve notes for Songtitle. It's actually a reissue of the album. It was originally released in, 1954. About the composer. This recording of the inimitable songs of Tom Lehrer has been issued in spite of widespread popular demand for its suppression, primarily for the benefit of a small but diminishing group of admirers of his dubious talent. Talent which have been on display for several years at functions, orgies and diverse festive occasions around Harvard University, where he was in attendance until June 1953 as an undergraduate, graduate student and teacher of mathematics. A few television and nightclub appearances have also been part of his infamous career. Now, at last, some of the songs for which he has been revolting local audiences for years are available to all, and it is no wonder the great deal of the public apathy has been stirred up at the prospect. For those who are unfamiliar with the details of his sordid life, brought so vividly to the screen in Quo Vadis, we offer a brief biographical note. Tom Lehrer, long-term exponent of the denier garde in American music, is an entirely mythical figure, a figment of his parents' warped imagination. He was raised by a yak, by whom he was always treated as one of the family, and ever since he was old enough to eat with the grown-ups, he has been merely the front for a vast syndicate of ne'er-do-wells. But enough of Tom Lehrer the artist. What of Lehrer the bon vivant, man about town and idol of three continents? At last reports he had settled in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he earns a precarious living, peddling dopes to local schoolchildren and rolling an occasional drunk. Here he spends his declining years with his shrunken head collection, his Nobel Prizes and his memories.
That was Travis Elbra reading the sleeve notes from Lehrer's songs by Tom Lehrer. This is Culture with me, Robert Bound. It's almost time to pull down the shutters on another culture show, but first, it's the wondrous mystery that is our 1 minute of sound. This week, our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, gets frisky with a little mic.
Stand.
Any kind of interesting sounds during
your
day?
Okay.
What's wrong with you?
What's going on? Is it what's going on? Stand. Just back. Stand.
What a charming thing. That was Hugo MacDonald's 1 minute of sound. Which brings us to the bit of the show where we have to mop the bar and send you home, hoping you've had an earful of an hourful of interesting, possibly cultural radio. I've been Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and our researcher was Hannah Jenkins. We're playing out with Dirty Windshield by Anna Brun from our Midori House session. Thanks for tuning in.
You smiled at me through a dirty windshield. You just got back from where the cyclone hid. You said you'd been in the center of it, where it was all so still. You still survived. You discovered a timeline without end. time fell, we talked about how you see life as a chain of moments in vain. They are stepping stones to lead you forward. You don't look over shoulders. The morning after you had a dream where you woke up with tattoos inside, engraved right there where your love resides.